Hello and welcome to this podcast from Polity, the fourth in a series of interviews with some of our leading authors. My name is George Miller, and I'm delighted to say that my guest today is Susan George. Susan George is an internationally renowned political scientist and author of over a dozen widely translated books. She was born in the Midwest during the Great Depression, but moved to France in the 1960s and subsequently took French citizenship. She still lives in Paris today. Susan George achieved prominence in 1976 with her first groundbreaking book, How the Other Half Dies, The Real Reason for World Hunger. After hunger, she went on to study the related problems of debt and poverty, interests which were reflected in books such as The Debt Boomerang and A Fate Worse Than Debt. George is president of the board of the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam, an international network of scholar activists committed to social change. Before we talked about her new book on our current predicament, Whose Crisis, Whose Future, I asked her about the values she had grown up with. Had the great collective effort made by the US in World War II been particularly influential?
Very much so, because Pearl Harbor is actually my first historical memory, distinguishing from something in your childhood to an historical thing, because I remember very well I was walking with my father and we were going to get an ice cream on Sunday, and he heard this on the radio of the shop where we went to get the ice cream, and he went absolutely quiet, and I remember how he reacted. And then after that, he did have to go to war, but after that everyone was involved. It was a period of incredible social cohesion. Children were involved. And as I say in the book, my godfather was named a dollar a year man because he was the president of a company called Goodyear Aircraft, and they were supplying products to the Air Force, and a dollar a year man was a very prestigious person who was meeting the quality and quantity targets of the government. And so I used to brag to my little school friends that my godfather was a dollar a year man, and I must have been completely insufferable, but that has also remained in my mind. But more than that, after the war, I also remember very well this incredible period of prosperity, of equality, of reform in the U.S. system, the GI Bill allowing ex-soldiers to go to college, most of them for the first time in their family's history, how many social laws were passed, how the beginning of the anti-racist civil rights movement began, etc. So I think, that the U.S. has gone off on the wrong track, but that's not so much the subject of the book. The reason I bring up the Second World War and that social cohesion and that incredibly fast conversion is that I believe we need a similar effort today to make the green conversion, to make the Green New Deal, that would absolutely transform our economies and allow us not only to survive but to thrive, as particularly as Westerners, as Europeans and Americans, because now is the time. I'm not pessimistic to the point that I say the point of no return has already been reached ecologically and climate-wise, but it's close enough. Nobody knows, first of all, but it's certainly close enough that one feels that now is the last moment to really make that conversion, and so I am sick to see the way the G20 is hemming and hawing, and nothing much is being done in this direction, and Copenhagen was a disaster, and we don't know what the next meetings are going to bring, but it really is business as usual so far, and so I'm perhaps crying in the wilderness to say that what we need is a green conversion on the scale of the Second World War conversion. But yes, it was a defining moment, and it was on the whole a social moment and a moment of prosperity in the United States, despite the war. Of course, we were not there physically. We weren't invaded. We weren't, and we weren't suffering like the Brits, that's for sure. But it was a defining moment in the history of the country where I was born.
And before we sort of come on to talk about the book in more detail, I just wondered, if you felt growing up in Ohio in the 30s and 40s, was your sort of value system laid down in those years? Did you sort of imbibe values that you think have remained with you and have informed your activism and your writing ever since?
Well, I am a typical WASP. The first people in my family arrived from England in 1632. I was born to two people who were upper middle-class families, and very standard American for that period. In other words, you were privileged, I was privileged, certainly, and you were expected to give something back, and you were expected very early in your life to give something back. I started visiting children's hospital when I was 11 or 12, taking toys, a round of books, or whatever. That's what my parents did and their parents did, just as a matter of course, because we were part of the bourgeoisie of this middle-sized city, and these values were simply automatic. In school, I went to camp in the summer, there also, fairness, justice, all of these things which we perhaps didn't call by those names, but considering personal qualities of loyalty, generosity, whatever. And yes, I think that this was very much the American spirit of a certain bourgeoisie at that time. And people can laugh at it now, but it really was also a quite solid foundation, and that has, yes, inspired me, certainly. I think the world can be different, in other words.
So were you already a fully formed political animal, if I can put it like that, by the time you went to the Sorbonne in the late 1960s, which obviously must also have been a time of great political ferment and change?
Absolutely not. I had no politics, or at least not what one would call having any politics today. I was alternating, I suppose, between Republicans and Democrats, but that didn't take you very far in the U.S. And I did not understand politics, as most Americans don't, in spite of studying government, as we called it, rather than political science at Smith, in Smith College, which is sort of the equivalent of Harvard or Yale for women. And it was really in France, where I moved in the late 50s, and I was married and I had three children, so there I wasn't developing many contacts in the political world either. But it really was through first the Algerian War in France, which I watched from a distance, but watched all the same, and allegations of torture and so on, and started reading a lot more. And then, of course, the Vietnam War. That's what transformed me, because it broke my heart. I could not believe that my, you know, country of birth was able to do these horrible things which were proven, which we knew about. And I joined the anti-war movement in 1967, and as an anecdote, I can tell you that I had to write to Noam Chomsky to know what to do. I didn't know Noam Chomsky, but he'd written articles about this, so I said, here I am, I'm a housewife, I've got three smallish children. What can I do? And he wrote to tell me that there was, very kindly, informed me that there was actually a Paris-American committee to stop war called PAX, which I joined as soon as I knew about it. But that's how I became a political person.
And the writing, did that start in the 1970s?
It started, really, because I had connections, because of the Vietnam War, to the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. And they were setting up an institute abroad, which they eventually put in Amsterdam because somebody gave us a building there. And it's called still, and it's still there, and I'm the board chair now. I've gone from dog's body to board chair. The Transnational Institute decided to put together a team to go to the World Food Conference in Rome in 1974. This was the first World Food Conference, and because I was editing the report and doing that sort of dog's body work, I learned a great deal about world hunger during the meetings of these experts, which I certainly was not. And when I got to Rome, I discovered that the two largest delegations were Americans and agribusiness people. So I thought, this is not at all, you know, this is not what we need. And there were a lot of problems that came both from the American agricultural policy and from the agribusiness sector. So after that, with another person, we both started writing, and then he moved off to do something else. And then I'd already been working on this for 6 or 7 months, and I thought, am I going to lose all this work or what? But I didn't have the courage to write something alone, and I asked somebody else, my new friend, because of food studies, will you help me? And he said, oh, write the book alone. Books by several people never do well. They're boring. Nobody buys them. And so I just went ahead, you know, totally blind faith. And then the great miracle of my life was that Penguin took the book, and it did very well, and that sort of launched me. And then from there I moved on to debt, because 10 years later, the friends from the South in the anti-hunger movement said, look, the biggest new contributing factor to hunger is debt. So you've got to do debt now. And I said, I can't. I don't know anything about money. I don't know about economics. They said, yes, yes, you can learn. You do very well. So I sat down and read and learned and started writing about debt. And then, as you know, one thing leads to another, and here we are.
And I suppose that's one of the messages you want to get across in the new book, is that problems are linked and that campaigners need to talk to each other and see the problems holistically rather than be simply peace campaigners or poverty campaigners.
Well, Whose Crisis, Whose Future is the title, and I wish that they put crisis in the plural, because it's whose crises. It really is a combination of many crises which are coming together and melding and making a kind of systemic or universal or complete integral crisis, whatever you want to call it. That's the reason that I talk about not just the financial crisis, which has moved the others more or less off the front pages, but also the crisis of poverty and inequality, which has been growing for 30 years, in spite of the success of a country like China to bring many people out of poverty. Even there, the inequalities are growing, and that poses other problems. Then there is the ongoing crisis of hunger, and to show how that's integrated, I explained how, why did food prices go up? Why did they double or triple in 2008? Well, because speculators on the financial markets were withdrawing from the subprime market and putting huge amounts of money, 30 times more than that exchange had ever seen, into wheat, soya, corn, rice, you know, food commodities. In one day, they drove up the price of wheat by 31%. And because the U.S. export price is the price in many places in the world, there were food riots in 30 different countries. It was the first time in history there had been a universal kind of food riot. Usually famines and hunger and so on are localized. But here you have people suddenly unable, simply because the price had doubled or tripled, to buy their basic staples. So that is integrated. There's also a crisis of water, which I discuss. And then instead of doing climate, which is, I think, deeply, deeply dangerous, I thought, but no, that's wrong. I said to myself, you've been putting a chapter about climate in every book you've done for the last 10 or 15 years. It's time to stop doing separate chapters. You've got to put this everywhere. So I tried to put the environment more or less everywhere, but I do devote a chapter to it mostly from the point of view of the conflicts that this is going to create, because this is an under-discussed aspect of climate change. Climate refugees, the uncovering of new resources over which there will be war, as in the Arctic, which is now going to be passable 3, 4, or 5 months of the year. This kind of thing, what water shortages do to conflicts, how this can kill a great many people, and for which our countries in Europe and in the US are simply not preparing. And there are going to be millions of people who simply can no longer live where they are, and they will be people from the South. So what are we going to do? Line up the machine guns and shoot them at the border? There aren't any plans. And so then the longest chapter of Whose Crisis, Whose Future is about solutions, because I really believe that we have all of the knowledge, all of the techniques, or all of the ideas that we need to transform the world and get rid of all of these things, to take out the links that hold these world crises together. And that means getting the banks under control. It means overhauling the financial system. And that's why I use the metaphor, which I put in the introduction, of how the world is organized today in concentric circles, where finance is the most important, and finance is guiding everything else, including the real economy, which is the second circle, but now much downgraded compared to finance, where in finance you can make profits four or five times as great as in the real economy, where real people work. And then society, which is constrained by both finance and the economy. And finally, the environment, which is nothing but a place to grab your resources and throw away your wastes. And what I am arguing is that the job of citizens today, because governments are not going to do it if we don't push, is to transform, to turn that metaphor inside out and make the planet the defining factor, which it is in reality, because we can't fight against the laws of physics. You always lose if you try to fight against natural laws, biological or physical. And then society, within those constraints of the environment, should be able to organize as it sees fit, democratically, but it would be quite different in different places. And then the economy is the way that society chooses to satisfy its needs. And finally, finance would be nothing but a tool, among other tools. And that's where I think we've gone wrong, allowing the order today, finance, economy, society, and society including the state and the environment, is absolutely the wrong direction. And it is going to lead us to new crises and to the brink. And because the G20 and the G8 seem blind, deaf, and not dumb, unfortunately, but blind and deaf, it seems to me that this task falls to citizens. Who else is going to do it? So that's why I also recommend that the only way to go forward is to start talking to people you've never talked to before. Make alliances. In Copenhagen, in the climate talks, the only good thing I could see that came out of that was that now the social movements and the ecological movements know that they are facing the same adversaries. And that is good, because now they work together as a matter of course. And that was, for me, a good step forward. But we need to make much better links between small farmers, trade unionists, ecologists, women who are acting for women's rights, and I think now small and medium-sized businesses. Nobody seems to have tried this yet. I don't know if it's doable, but those businesses are suffering because the banks aren't lending to them and they're starved for credit, not because they're badly managed, but because they simply are being cut off. And so there's a great many forces in the society, and the only people who profit from the status quo are this tiny fringe that I call the Davos class, the people who go and meet in Switzerland every January to see what they're going to do next. And they're the only ones that really get something out of the way society is organized today. And everybody else is suffering to a greater or a lesser degree. The poor, of course, more than the middle class, but the middle class is not doing all that well. And now we're being told we have to pay a second time for this crisis. I like to give this figure, which I found in a really super report by two people at the Bank of England, including the Director for Financial Stability. And they wrote a report called Banking on the State, in which they explained historically why the state used to be actually ruining the banks when the sovereign borrowed for his wars. And that could wreck the banks if they made the wrong choice and if they were on the losing side. Now it's the other way around. It's the state that is being bankrupted for saving the banks. And they give lots of interesting historical detail, but the main point is that up to now, in a whole variety of support packages, the governments of the UK, the US, and Europe have provided about $14 trillion to save the financial system. And since $14 trillion is 14 with 12 zeros, but this is an incomprehensible number, I transformed it into seconds. So when you have $1 per second, you can look at your watch for 450,000 years before you get to 14 trillion. This gives an idea of the volume that we've already contributed, okay? So now we're being told we have to contribute a second time through austerity programs because the states borrowed and they expanded and they created greater deficits in order to save the banks. So now it's up to the citizens once more to pay and get absolutely nothing in return. Paying through cuts in salaries, cuts in public services, with austerity in various government departments which are indispensable, like education, housing, healthcare, and so on. It's not up to citizens to do this. And the world is awash in money, and I explain where that money is and how to go after it, because we know where it is, and we know what to do, except there isn't the political stamina to do it. And the governments, it's almost as if you vote for a government, and then they hand over the important things to the banking sector, you know. I mean, why not just vote directly for the bankers? It would be quicker and easier and more honest. You know, there's a lot wrong with the world, but I do have faith because I'm old enough to have this sort of long historical view. I see that it takes a long time to change things. I've been in many struggles which are not won yet, and they have been going on for 30 years. However, I have also seen that more people are coming together. We had one victory in 1998 over this awful treaty that the transnational corporations wanted called the MAI, the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, which would have given all powers to transnational corporations and none to states. We beat that. We got rid of it. Since then, we've had a lot of good campaigns against the World Trade Organization, against the IMF and the World Bank. They are obliged to listen to what citizens say now. And it's just becoming natural for people to work together from different sectors. When you have a big issue, you come together. We are coming together very naturally in continental Europe. I give the example of France, which is my country now, where I'm a citizen, where we have a coalition on financial transaction taxes, in other words, tax every transaction at one per thousand, which could raise an enormous amount of money for good causes. And we've got the four main trade unions, we've got the two major ecological organizations, a lot of NGOs, and my own organization, ATTAC, and it's become quite natural to work on these really big questions together. So this gives me hope. I speak about hope rather than optimism or pessimism. People in audiences always ask you, are you optimistic or are you pessimistic? And I just say I don't answer that question because I don't know the future. But I do have hope because I have seen things changing over the long term. And I know people are impatient. I'm impatient. But I also now, I think, can see a certain historical development, and it's a race against time, particularly for the environment. If it were just politics and society, you can say, well, we have time to go back and start over, you know, get rid of slavery, for instance. That sort of thing takes time. But we don't have time for the environment, so that's why I'm pleading with people to talk to their neighbors and see what they can do together.
In your first book, you were already saying, don't study the poor, study the rich and powerful. Mm. And you're saying that still in this book. Why are you saying it, firstly, and why do you think the message still hasn't quite got through?
Well, I'm saying study the rich and not the poor because the poor know what's wrong with their lives. They don't need you and me as researchers and writers to tell them. But beyond that, who actually has the power? It's not the poor. So we know everything about the poor. I mean, the World Bank issues innumerable reports. There's a new agency in Brazil, funded mostly by Canada, which does nothing but study the poor. We know how many calories they consume. We know about how many sinks they have, how many toilets. It's just endless, you know, the reports. Well, this is fine, because at least you can't say, I didn't know it was that bad. But, you know, let's get real here. Let's look at who are the people who are keeping things that way, because it's not a question of money. There is plenty of money in the world. And when I speak about a financial transactions tax and the coalition that we are building, we've already built in France, but we are trying to extend it to other countries, particularly in Europe, and there is also a similar effort in Britain. And that is because these coalitions behind a financial transactions tax, if this tax existed throughout the world, it would raise $600 billion a year. And our agreement with our partners in the coalition is one-third for repairing the social systems in the north where the transactions take place, one-third to bring people out of dire and endemic poverty in the south, one-third to mitigate climate change everywhere, transfer the technology that is needed, pay the people in China, India, Brazil, etc., who are saying quite rightly that we began our industrial revolution decades, if not hundreds of centuries ago, and it's their turn now. So yes, but we should be helping them to reduce the amount of energy used per unit of GNP, which is much higher than ours now, because we've had experience. So, $200 billion for each of those things yearly would really transform the world. And I think this is it's a good avenue of struggle, but that too is going to be long-term, because across the table, well, not even the table, but they don't talk to us, but across the open space, we've got these adversaries who are screaming, just as the same people did in the early 1900s when they first mooted the question of income taxes, okay? Now we're saying international taxes. We can't stop at the borders, because the problems do not stop at the borders, obviously. And they're screaming in exactly the same way, that this will be confiscation. Well, one per thousand is not confiscation, I'm sorry. But it would raise that much money. And this is one of the solutions, but I try to provide a great many others.
As I was reading the book, I was wondering about the phenomenon of people voting for governments who transact legislation which is not in their best interest. I'm thinking about, you know, voting for George Bush, not once, but twice. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the example of the Australians who, having suffered the worst drought in their country's history, vote for a government of the right, which is basically not sympathetic to climate change. And I thought this sort of leads us into the realm of ideas in people's heads, and how people become convinced that voting in a certain way is actually in their interest, and in fact what's being done is privatisation and things are being sold off and so on. So that seemed to me to bring in the media and communications. So tell me what your analysis of that situation is.
Well, now you are evoking actually my previous book, which is called Hijacking America, because in that book I try to explain exactly in contemporary historical terms, where did this ideology come from? Because it really has become the common sense of look at the Tea Party. These people just mouth the same things over and over again. Poor people are poor because they want to be poor. The government is too big. We don't need the government. Private is always better than public. We don't want public health care. We don't want to spend money on any of these things. If people don't pay for it themselves, they don't deserve it, etc., etc. And this is manufactured. And it is manufactured by a small elite which began in the 1950s to forge their concepts of neoliberal thought, if you want to call it thought, at a time when absolutely everyone was a Keynesian, more or less left or right, but a Keynesian, you know. I mean, he was called Man of the Year by Time magazine in 1965. And 30 years later, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher had triumphed. So the way it was done was, yes, through media, but not only. It was done by paying people to produce and disseminate ideas, paying for think tanks, paying for conferences in colleges, for publications, going after the places and the people who organize and create and disseminate ideas. The title of a book of one of these people in 1948 was Ideas Have Consequences. And I think that that was an admirable title, which has proven absolutely true. The world runs on ideas, and I call the people who pulled this off, with the help of large private foundations belonging to extreme right-wing people, I call them the right-wing Gramscians, because they've understood Antonio Gramsci, who explained the Marxist, Italian Marxist who died in Mussolini's prison and invented the concept of cultural hegemony. And he explained that you don't get power by bludgeoning people and oppressing them. You get it by getting into their heads through what he called the long march through the institutions. And that's what this class of people, particularly in the United States, but it's got its younger brothers and sisters in Britain and elsewhere, and they're setting up a whole ring of these institutes that do nothing but disseminate these same ideas. Eastern Europe, they've been concentrating very heavily on. And so, yes, you need money, management, media. The Heritage Foundation in the U.S. brags that it gives 6-point-something interviews every working day to the national and international press. They've got 2 television studios on their premises. These people understand how if you repeat something often enough, you can make any lie seem like the truth, and then people vote on it. There's a certain amount of literature now about this. I published this in 2007, and Hijacking America, it was okay, and it went to a certain number of people in universities, but it did not become a book that was commonly discussed because everybody was in Obamania mode, you know? And everything was going to change now, whereas I had put on the back cover, the first sentence was, George Bush leaves the White House and everything goes back to normal. Right? Wrong. Da-da-da-da. And we now see, with the rise of the Tea Party, with the way that Obama himself has given Wall Street a free pass, how he is not able, really, to cope with all of these ideas, because the left, or the progressives, they're not even left, don't even think about defending their ideas. I believe they seem to have this impression, well, our ideas are the best because they're more generous, they're more inclusive, whatever, and there's no reason to talk about that because it's completely obvious. Well, it's not. And the left spends nothing on ideas. I know because I'm a fundraiser often for TNI, for Transnational Institute, and we deal in promoting certain ideas and case studies and so on. We are a research-oriented, but action. Everyone who's a fellow of TNI is involved in the social movements of their own place, and they live in a great many different places. But they are also scholars and writers, and that's because we believe that you have to study the rich and the powerful and not the poor and powerless. A long answer to a short question.
Susan, my final question is, I suppose, the $64,000 question, and you pose it yourself in the book, so maybe here you can just sort of sketch out how you respond to it. And that question is, can we save the planet while international capitalism remains the dominant system?
It is the terrible question. And I think that capitalism has to change, but I see that there is not any revolution on the horizon, and certainly not one that would engulf the world. And I don't know who the Tsar is, and I don't know where the Winter Palace is that we would have to storm if we wanted to have a revolution. I know it isn't on Wall Street, because Wall Street has shown its resilience no matter what happens. Whoop, they're up and running again 5 days later, or they get saved by the state, or whatever. So, under those circumstances, what does one do? First, you try to take as many activities out of the market as you can. Public services, water, energy, I believe. I don't think they should be in the market. I think they should be arbitrated by the state, and some of these should be free, like the first 40 liters of water for everybody, and some should be priced according to whatever conservation measures you want to have, etc. But I think unless we can say to the banks, you wouldn't be here and if it weren't for us and our money, because it's ours, and from now on you are going to lend particularly to small and medium enterprise that has an ecological project. You are going to lend to families that want to refit their houses with solar panels or better glazing or whatever. You are going to behave in the following ways and just make them do it because they belong to us, strictly speaking. We have paid to save them. So any bank that has received public money, in my view, ought to be at least partially socialized. There are ways to do this while the capitalist system is going to keep ticking over. Unfortunately, we know that's the case. Nobody wants Soviet-style socialism. Certainly I don't. I believe the market plays a useful role. The problem is to get capitalism once more a little bit more under control, which we have totally lost. Total deregulation. They do exactly as they please, and the G20 has gone back to business as usual in that department. Also, I note that the venture capitalists in places like California, who underwrote Silicon Valley startups and various small companies, some of which became Google, Microsoft, and various huge companies now, are investing heavily in green concepts because they see that this is going to be a huge moneymaker. So I'm saying, why does it always have to be capital that sees these things? Why can't we, as citizens, have some control over this? That, I'm not asking for the moon. I'm asking for states to have funds to put into these startups. Maybe they get spun off later. I don't know. But at least we have some control over what they become. And you can also have a social project that goes along with the ecological one, because just as we spent centuries excluding the creativity of women, we are still excluding the creativity of workers, and who are arranged hierarchically and are not supposed to have an opinion. Whereas I also give a long example of this 30-year-old practice here in Britain of the Lucas Aerospace workers, which was absolutely unbelievable to reread what they accomplished before ecology was even on the map. They invented all these environmentally friendly products, which would have made Britain the epitome of the world economy today if they had not been, if these workers and technicians and engineers had not been forced to stop by the unions, unfortunately, by the Labour Party, unfortunately, who had no vision. It was the workers who had. So, I mean, these things could happen again, but we have to free up the political system in one part and get it together and under control in another part.
Susan George. Whose Crisis, Whose Future is available now in both hardback and paperback. The other book we discussed in the interview, Hijacking America, is also available. Full details can be found on the Polity website at polity.co.uk. That's all for this Polity podcast. But I hope you'll join me again soon for another in-depth interview. And until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.